are tuned in to Mid-Morning Empowerment here on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
All right, beautiful music right there on our music takeover, bringing us into our mental health chat. We're going to be joined in just a moment by Hanlie van der Westhuizen from the Vista Clinic, and we are talking once again about our subject for this month, psychosis. Today we're focusing on psychosis and substance abuse. Now, psychosis and substance use often walk hand in hand, but is it cause or effect, or is it both? Today, we're exploring this complex connection and how substance use can muddy the waters of diagnosis and recovery. Hanlie, good morning. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Bongi. Thanks so much.
All right. So let's get straight into it, Hanlie. Which substances would you say are most commonly linked to psychosis?
Yeah. Substance use is a well-established risk factor for the onset. Exacerbation and the relapse of psychosis. Certain substances can directly trigger psychotic episodes, especially in vulnerable individuals, and they can also worsen existing psychotic symptoms. Cannabis, marijuana, or as people often know it, weed or dacha, is the most strongly linked substance. Cannabis, particularly high potency strains, has the most robust evidence linking it to psychosis. The risk increases if you use it during adolescence or early adulthood. The risk of developing psychosis is approximately 2 or 3 times stronger in that at developmental stage. There's also a dose response relationship. Higher frequency use or potency of the cannabis use correlate with a greater risk.
Continue.
Other drugs also have an influence. If we look at the amphetamines, like cocaine, there is a psychosis induction. And because these drugs increases the dopamine levels dramatically, they can induce the hallucinations and the paranoid delusions, often also agitation, which features primary psychotic disorder. So heavy or chronic use of cocaine or amphetamines can lead to persistent psychotic symptoms even after stopping the drug, especially with high doses. Then if you look at your psychedelics, the LSD in DMT, they cause a transient psychosis. Classic psychedelics can induce hallucinations and delusional thinking during intoxication, but they also can trigger vulnerable individuals. In some cases, use may precipitate a persistent psychotic episode, especially those with a genetic or environmental vulnerability. Then our other substances, alcohol, although alcohol is not directly linked to primary psychosis, heavy use can cause withdrawal delirium or exacerbate existing mental health conditions. In South Africa, we also have to look at other drugs. The street drug tuk, which is a form of meth, can cause psychosis, especially when used in high doses and over a long, prolonged period of time. It is really a powerful central nervous system stimulant, and it can really lead to a range of mental health issues, including psychosis, but very often anxiety and paranoia, and mood disturbances. The risk with intake usually increases with higher doses, frequent use, and prolonged usage. In some cases, schizophrenia can even persist long after people have stopped the drug. But in many cases, the symptoms does resolve when there's abstinence. Another street drug known to South Africans is Norpe, which is a mixture of various substances. And, Norpe can use adverse mental health effects, including psychosis, especially with heavy or prolonged use. But the issue here with Norpe is that because it's a street drug, there's a variable in its purity, and there's often adulteration that can increase the risk of adverse effects, mm-hmm. including health, mental health mm-hmm. issues. It's really concerning because people really don't know what is in the drug when they use it. So it's a high risk drug. Other street drugs in South Africa, like Mandrax, it's a sedative hypnotic drug, sometimes misused recreationally. Overdose or chronic use can lead to confusion, hallucinations, and psychosis. Mm-hmm. Then, homemade or adulterated substances, many street drugs are adulterated with other chemicals, which, as I said, can increase the risk. And, synthetic drugs are usually, very unpredictable in terms of its effect on mental health. I don't know if the listeners know of a street name called bath salts. These stimulants can cause severe agitation mm-hmm. and psychosis. And then our inhalants, the glues, the aerosols, the solvents that people sometimes inhale, very, very often used recreationally in some communities, they can cause hallucinations, confusion, and psychosis, especially with chronic use. Mm-hmm. The issue, risk factors are high doses and frequent use. As I mentioned, the purity of the street drugs are a risk factor. Underlying mental issues or genetic predisposition usually makes people more vulnerable. And then polydrug use, that is using multiple substances simultaneously, also increases risk.
Mm. You mentioned that when they get off whatever that substance might be, sometimes the symptoms might persist. Do they ever become permanent?
Substance-induced psychosis typically occurs during or shortly after the use of a certain substance, such as high doses of stimulants, like cocaine or, LSD or whatever you use. In many cases, the psychosis resolves once the substance has been metabolized and eliminated from the body, and also especially with appropriate treatment and support. But I need to say here, while most cases of substance-induced psychosis are temporary, there are some situations where the psychosis can become permanent, persistent, and chronic. Mm-hmm. The reasons here is the underlying vulnerability. Some individuals with a predisposition or primary psychotic disorder like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder with psychotic features may experience a substance-induced psychosis that trigger or unearths mm-hmm. the underlying condition, which then persists even after the substance use stops.
Okay.
Then also prolonged or heavy substance use, chronic use, heavy use of certain substances, particularly stimulants like meth or cocaine, has been associated with long-lasting or even permanent psychotic symptoms. And then also delayed and inadequate treatment. If substance-induced psychosis is not promptly treated, or if there's ongoing substance use, the risk of persistent symptoms may increase. It's also important here to mention neurotoxic effects. Some substances can cause lasting neurochemical or structural brain changes, which may contribute to persistent psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
And, I have mentioned in previous sessions that I had with you that we look at factors like oxidative stress and inflammation as hypotheses for the cause of psychosis, in addition to the well-established dopamine hypothesis. But what is interesting about the neurotoxic effects of substances, the mechanism of neurotoxicity, is that they generate reactive oxygen species, leading to oxidative damage to neurons and glial cells.
Wow.
And then there's also the risks of excitotoxicity, that is excessive stimulation of the glutamate receptors. And, this unfortunately can lead to calcium influx and neural injury, mm-hmm. and it can even cause death of the neurons. So that is a high risk. And then inflammation, chronic substance use can activate microglia leading to neuroinflammation. This is also true of the damage that alcohol causes.
Okay.
And it usually causes disruption in the neurotransmitter systems. You know, substances can alter your dopamine, serotonin, glutamate, and other neurotransmitter pathways, and it can impair your normal brain function. And then there's also, you know, some drugs can directly damage neuronal cell membranes. So or unfortunately, neurotoxic outcomes, you know, structural brain changes. I've seen that in private practice where, you know, there's loss of gray matter, there's white matter abnormalities, and there's even atrophy in some specific regions of the brain. So leading to long-term and permanent cognitive deficits, and those neurotransmitter system disruptions can often, you know, make it very, very difficult to treat the underlying symptoms.
Right.
And very often we look at persistent hallucinations, delusions, mood disturbances, you know, sometimes resembling primary psychiatric disorders.
Mm-hmm.
So the main thing here is genetics. Very, very important here, and I'm hoping that people hear this high risk factor is the age of initiation. Adolescents are more vulnerable due to the ongoing brain development and the disruption that the drugs causes in that brain development. So high risk if you initiate drug use early, and then obviously the dose and duration.
Okay. And how can clinicians distinguish between psychosis and substance effects?
That is a common and important challenge in clinical practice. But the key principles in differentiating substance effects from psychosis is usually the timing and the history of substance use. You know, the onset of the symptoms relative to the substance use. And then also the pattern of use, you know, that gives us quite a good clue of what is going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then also we look at the duration, the course of the symptoms. Is it transient versus persistent? Substance-induced psychosis usually remits within days, 2 weeks after stopping the substance, where your primary psychotic disorder tend to have a more chronic course with episodes over months or years.
Mm-hmm.
So also we look at the symptom profile. Your psychotic symptoms typically in the substance-induced psychosis often involves more visual or tactile hallucinations, paranoid delusions, and agitation, where your primary psychosis often involves more complex delusional system, disorganized thinking, negative symptoms, and hallucinations are often auditory. So another very, very important clue is insight. Our patients with substance-induced psychosis usually have better insight, especially after cessation,
mm-hmm.
where our primary psychotic patients usually involves poor insight. There's usually a clinical context and comorbidities that we need to assess. And then we also got laboratory, and toxicology screens,
mm-hmm.
that can also, you know, help us to rule out other causes. But those are not usually definite in the psychosis diagnosis, but it is part of the assessment.
Okay.
So we usually have a very practical approach in the clinical setting. It's the initial assessment where we get a detailed history of the substance use and we assess the timeline. And then very, very important in this case is our observation and follow-up. We monitor symptoms over time, especially after abstinence.
Mm-hmm.
And we assess in a period of sustained abstinence to see whether symptoms resolve. And then very important clues are treatment response. You know, if the response to antipsychotic medication is positive, that also gives us some clues. And then very important, if the patient allows us collateral information, You know, to gather information from family, friends, and previous medical records can really clarify the course and the history.
Right.
So, you know, in summary, what I can say is that substance-induced psychosis is typically closely tied to a recent substance use, and it tends to resolve with abstinence and may have a different symptom profile, where our primary psychotic disorder usually have an insidious onset. It's more chronic in course and may persist beyond substance use cessation. Mm. A very important factor here is transparent sharing. It's really crucial for us to get an accurate assessment, diagnosis, and to plan the treatment. And it can be a significant barrier in clinical practice if you don't have transparent sharing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really, really important. It influences accurate diagnosis, effective treatment, monitoring progress, and also safety considerations. So it's really important. There are often barriers, you know, involved in transparent sharing. First of all, the stigma and the shame. It's really self-explanatory. Mm-hmm. But then also, you know, fear. People have fear of legal or social consequences. You know, they have concerns about legal repercussions if they share, you know, the substance use history. They may lose custody over their children. Mm-hmm. There may be employment issues.
Right.
You know, those are all factors that can lead to withholding information, which makes it difficult. But you know, we do have sometimes denial or minimalization, but it's usually this fear of legal or social consequences that influence, you know, transparent sharing.
Yeah.
But clinicians does a lot to combat these, and we try to create a non-judgmental environment. You know, we ensure confidentiality. We try to build rapport, and we try to normalize the conversation. And where possible, and where individuals allow us, we try to involve family for support reasons mainly.
Mm-hmm.
So that is what we try to do to build the trust and the transparency in the relationship.
Sure. And what support is available for individuals with dual diagnoses? Is there any support for them?
I first want to explain to listeners the term dual diagnosis. The dual diagnosis refers to a co-occurrence of a mental health disorder and a substance use disorder, right, in the same individual. So this is also a situation known as a comorbid mental illness and substance abuse disorder. The dual diagnosis is quite common. It's quite common in prevalence. Many individuals with mental health conditions such as depression, anxiety, or bipolar disorder, or schizophrenia also struggles with substance use issues.
Mm-hmm.
What is important for people to understand that there's a bidirectional relationship in this diagnosis. And the reason for that is there's the self-medication hypothesis. So some individuals use substances to cope or to alleviate symptoms of mental illness.
Okay.
So that is important to know that. There's also the substance-induced mental illness component. We do believe that substance use can precipitate or even worsen psychiatric symptoms. And then there's the whole relationship between shared risk factors. There is generally genetic, environmental, or neurobiological factors that may predispose the individual to both conditions. So dual diagnosis usually means that the treatment is a little bit more complex. It's a little bit more challenging. The reason for this is because, you know, the substance use can interfere with the treatment of the mental illness. You know, it psychiatric symptoms may obscure or mimic substance-related issues. And patients may have difficulty engaging in treatment due to denial, stigma, or cognitive impairment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important to have an integrated treatment approach, you know, when we can address the conditions both simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So coordination among mental health, addiction specialists, and social services improves outcomes. So the multidisciplinary approach, which I mentioned earlier in our conversations, is very imperative here. So integrated treatment approach, personalized holistic care, psychosocial interventions, and very important medication management is very important also for the substance use assisted treatment. So that is, you know, that those all really, really help with relapse prevention and support, because in the dual diagnosis, the relapse is a high risk.
Right, right. And how can prevention campaigns address both substance use as well as mental health, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, campaigns help raise awareness and education, and they inform the public and they dispel myths, and it highlights early signs. But yeah, on the issue of raising awareness and education, I want to mention something that I think particularly can help individuals that with dual diagnoses. And I'm going to refer back to my early days as a psychologist. I was very young when I qualified, and I was in the consultation room of a very older psychiatrist, and we were talking about an individual who particularly struggled with substance use disorder. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very, very it was life changing for me in terms of viewing my field and diagnosis, when the psychiatrist reflected on this individual with immense compassion, immense care, and viewing the illness as totally, totally removed from what I grew up with, you know, alcoholism, substance use disorder.
Right.
Really reflecting on a person's, you know, lack of morals, you know, and basically reflecting in the lack of a person. But the psychiatrist was saying that this person is ill and we need to help this person. And it was so removed from moral failing or weakness. And I want to just, you know, say to the listeners that we view it as a brain disorder. There's a very strong neurobiological basis or substance use disorder,
right,
that involve changes in the brain circuits related to reward, motivation, impulse control, mm-hmm. and decision making. So we see it, like diabetes, as a chronic illness, and we also view that these genetic and environmental factors playing a key role in influencing individual vulnerability. Mm-hmm. So it's really, you know, we view it similar to other psychiatric disorders. And what is also important is that there's really medication-assisted treatment plans for substance use. There are a lot of medications, methadone, naltrexone, there's so many, that akin to, you know, psychiatric medication can help people, you know, fight the battle against substance use. So I think if we look at education and campaigns, if the public realizes that there's treatment available and how our professionals view their vulnerabilities, that can help a lot. Mm-hmm. But back to campaigns and prevention campaigns, I think we need to target vulnerable populations. Our youth and our adolescents are particularly vulnerable, and we should focus our campaigns to allow them to know that they are a high-risk group, and early use of substances may lead to mental health problems.
Right.
It's also important here that we advocate. I mean, there's also, I can't talk about campaigns without acknowledging structural issues in South Africa, because poverty is very much linked to substance use.
Yes.
And the reason for this is that people in poverty-ridden communities have really lack to access of you know, other creational activities like art or sport or cultural activities.
Yeah.
There's just no access to it. So, you know, alcohol or tic or inhalants have become a way to cope.
Yeah.
So we need to keep that in mind. And I think as much as we talk about campaigns, I think we can do a lot with social upliftment. We can do a lot in terms of outreach programs and to help communities better their circumstances to allow them to have better quality of life.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Handy, for coming through once again. A very interesting conversation as always. And we continue learning. We continue growing our knowledge and our understanding of the condition. Thank you so much for your time this morning. God bless you.
Thanks so much, Bongi. See you again. Bye-bye.
You are tuned in to Mid-Morning Empowerment here on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.